to give you a little bit of background about Dr. Miller. He graduated from Billings High School in 2002, and he earned his doctorate from the University of California, Irvine, in political science in 2013. He traveled to Finland as a Fulbright scholar to study that country's electoral college in 2016-2017. His research interests include American and comparative politics, voting behaviors, political institutions, and public option. His work has been published in the Annual Review of Political Science, the Election Law Journal, American Politics Research, and the Journal of Elections, Public Opinions, and Parties. He will begin his work at the Brennan Center in New York City, leaving this next weekend. Please welcome Dr. Peter Miller.
I've been invited to give a couple of thoughts on the American Electoral College, sort of how it operates, its function in American politics, and a couple of comments on an effort to, say, change how the Electoral College functions in America. This is mostly directed by the leadership of the League. So they were very kind, and they sent me an email that said, here are some questions. If you can respond to those, that would be great. And being a senior high graduate, I'm very good at answering questions. And so here we go. We'll see how things go. Okay. I'll just address a couple of points. The first is that we'll go back to the founding and give you a sense of what was the intent of the Electoral College when the Constitution was being drafted. How did it function, at least initially? What did the founders intend? And then how does that measure up with how things have gone since the introduction of the Constitution and as, you know, more than 200 years now of electoral experience in the United States? I'll comment on a couple of biases that have crept into the system over time, give some of a discussion about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact as a alternative to this current system, and then tell you a little bit about my time in Finland, a little bit about Finnish politics. In particular, the Finns abolished their electoral college in the early 90s, and that may help inform similar processes and discussions that are going on in the United States. And then I'll end with some conclusions, then I'll be happy to take your questions. We actually don't have a pretty good idea of what the Electoral College was intended to do, thanks to the written statements from the Founding Fathers. As I'm sure most of you will know, the Constitution was drafted in Philadelphia in 1787, and then there was an effort across the country at the time to ratify this Constitution. And there were a series of essays written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay advocating for the adoption of this Constitution as a replacement to the Articles of Confederation. And the 68th essay on selecting the president was probably written by Alexander Hamilton. He took a break from working on his musical that took him a little bit to work on, and so that he describes the functioning of this electoral college. And it seems pretty clear from the intent of this essay that the college itself is intended to insulate the president and the presidency from either foreign or domestic influence. The idea here is that you want to make sure that whoever the president is not in the pocket of some interest, either on the global or domestic stage. So at the time, of course, The big deal in the superpowers at the time was between Great Britain and France. One faction in American politics thought we should ally ourselves with the French. One side thought we should be more friendly with the British. And so the concern here is that, you might imagine that one of these powers could, through intrigue or otherwise, decide that, you know, the American Republic is now, say, an appendage of either the French or British system. And so what we're seeing is this electoral college is designed to make it as difficult as possible to manipulate the selection of who the president would be. How do they do that? Well, this college only exists for a single purpose, right? So the people who are in the electoral college only come together for one job, right? They're there to select the president. And they do this with the temporary and sole purpose of making the appointment, right? So they come together, they make one decision, and then they disperse. So in terms of trying to coordinate an effort to manipulate the process, you'd have to be in the room when these folks are actually casting the ballots, which sounds easy, except the room that we're referring to is usually the state capitals, right? And there's usually going to be a group of people standing around. So it might be difficult to, say, walk over and hand them an envelope full of money, right? William Clark, William Andrews Clark style. But rather, the idea here is that they're only there to do one job. And so therefore, it's not like you can say, well, if you horse trade one vote, well, then we can do something else for you later on. That doesn't exist. That possibility is impossible. The other thing to remember is that the Electoral College is presumably populated by studious persons, meaning people who are educated and interested in the fate of the American Republic. I think it's pretty clear that the founders had a dim view of the possibility of the American people at large to conduct their affairs. And think of it this way, that in the original formulation, the House of Representatives is the only directly elected branch of the federal government. Right? At the time, the Senate was appointed by state legislatures. The president is elected by the Electoral College. The people themselves have a limited role in who their governors would be. Similarly, the idea here is that perhaps the American electorate is ill-equipped to reasonably answer the question, who should be the president? Right? Of course, this has changed over time, but at least that was the original formulation. The electorate back in the day was white males who owned property who were over the age of 21. You're already looking at a pretty small selection of the society. And then you consider that the founding fathers themselves, if they had any formal education, it was mostly in Latin and Greek. And yet they put together a pretty beautiful document in the form of the Constitution. The Electoral College is unique in the sense that they act as a group, but separately, in the sense that you have subgroups of electors meeting in various state capitals throughout the country. So if you're wanting to manipulate the process, you have to have a sufficiently large conspiracy to be affecting every state capital at the time. And they're acting as a group in the sense that it's happening at the same time. So it's not like, say, Maine is voting on Monday, Vermont votes on Tuesday, California votes in 3 weeks. Because the idea there would be the folks at the end of the game at least know what the folks at the beginning of the game have done. That's also impossible because all of these votes take place at the exact same time. And so they're then, to be even more formal, they're put in boxes and then mailed to the U.S. Senate for a formal tabulation of the votes. And so that they already know the vote at the beginning, they know the vote at the end, and so if there's any manipulation in transit, you can also identify it that way. Just to remind you that the founders were aware of the potential for foreign intrigue, and so that, of course, the most deadly adversaries of Republican government might approach from more than one quarter, but chiefly from the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. Have the president in their pocket, right? It's a good thing that that's never happened. So this is at least the Electoral College as it was intended and as it operated in the early days of the Republic and has continued more or less to operate since then. What has changed? Well, of course, the founders were pretty intelligent people on average, but they were not perfect, right? And that they did make some mistakes and they were unable to see the future. Apparently, their crystal balls were not very good. One thing that is abundantly clear is that the Electoral College imposes a system in which some states matter more than others. Right? So we might think of ourselves in something like the animal farm dictum of all animals are equal, some animals are more equal than others. Right? Some states matter more than others in terms of the Electoral College. There seems to be a conventional wisdom that rural states are overrepresented in the Electoral College. I think instead a better interpretation may be competitive states have a more important role in the Electoral College. California and Montana similarly have very little role in presidential politics, not because one is large and the other is small, is that neither of them are competitive. Why is that? Well, one candidate is pretty sure they're going to win either one or the other state, and so therefore they have no incentive to campaign there. The other campaign has forsworn ever winning the state, so they also don't campaign there. So what you end up with is a small slice of the country, relatively speaking, decides the election, right? Because they're the ones that command the overwhelming intention from candidates. Those candidates then pay more attention to issues that matter to those particular states to the exclusion of the rest of the country. Right? Then, of course, campaigns are rational and strategic institutions. They know what they're doing. They're trying to win. And so that they focus their energy where they can get the most bang for their buck. And for most of the time, that means excluding a lot of the country and paying a lot of attention to the states that could potentially tip the election one way or the other. And oftentimes, Montana is not on that list of competitive states. I still don't know why. So it's part of a long-term research project. Right? I'm in my 35th year, and I'm still working on collecting data. Right? So the second question that has arisen over time is that, are the American people able to make this decision meaningfully? We might imagine if we go back to the original formulation of the American electorate, you're looking at a pretty small slice of the American population. As I'm sure everyone in the room knows, the character and demographic characteristics of the American electorate has changed. Notably, in 1920, women get the vote. In 1965, racial and ethnic minorities get protections for the vote, even though those protections really come from the 14th Amendment that was ratified a century earlier, but that's a topic for another time. And so the idea is that the American electorate has dramatically changed in composition since the founding. The other thing is that the Electoral College was originally intended as a means to have studious persons making an important decision. Nowadays, with a dramatically different media environment, it's possible for any of us to become immediately informed to the degree that we want to know anything about the election with the push of a button on our phones. Right? And so the sense that in an era when it took months to travel from Boston to New York, I can now get the sum total of human knowledge in my pocket. Right? This is a completely different world that the founders could not have intended. And so one argument may be, with the ease of information, it's pretty easy for me to now, as just a private citizen, realize where the candidates stand on a particular issue, and I can vote with an informed perspective on the election relative to back in the 1780s when you were probably thinking, oh, is George Washington running again? I sure liked him last time, right? And so the one argument is that the Electoral College was designed for a system that is no longer an accurate representation of the country. A separate element are these so-called faithless electors, meaning that once you're elected to the Electoral College, you're under no coercion in order to vote in a particular manner. And so over time, you have seen people who have defected from the anticipated vote. All right, so 2016 is remarkable because six electors ended up defecting from what their states had voted on. Relatively speaking, six electors is pretty high. However, we're talking about a college of 538, and so one argument is that they haven't made a pivotal change, but they might be problematic, and in the future we may see an election in which there's a wholesale rebellion within the Electoral College and we end up with, say, Mickey Mouse as president, which would probably be a surprise to everyone, including the estate of Walt Disney. The other problem that I'll spend a little more time talking about is that sometimes the winner of the popular vote does not win the election. And this has happened four or five times in American history, depending on how you count 1824. This refers to the so-called corrupt bargain, which is when the House of Representatives elects John Quincy Adams president over Andrew Jackson, despite Andrew Jackson winning more of the votes in the election itself. The good news, at least from an empirical perspective, is that as far as we social scientists can tell, there was no corrupt bargain. And instead, that's just Andrew Jackson complaining about not getting the presidency and having to wait an additional 4 years. What is clear, however, is that in 1876, 1888, 2000, and now 2016, you've had four instances where the winner of the popular vote did not win the election. And so we end up with something like the loser won the election, and this just seems on its face to be an absurd conclusion of any election. We would expect the winner to win. After all, that's why we call them winners. Right. And so the one argument may be there's something about these four elections that might be a little goofy, and so I'll spend a couple of minutes chatting about those. When we're thinking about the place of the Electoral College in American politics, naturally we probably think of in the form of some question like, should the Electoral College be abolished? And while that might be helpful, I think a different way to address the same issue is, should the election of the American president be a direct election? Because if we think that's the case, if we think the American people are now equipped with the ability to select their chief executive on their own and in a direct fashion, that asking the question about a direct election may inform the process a bit easier than, say, should we get rid of this thing in the status quo? Just in part because the process of political reform is always problematic for the reformers. The status quo is a pretty powerful position to be in. It's designed that way. If instead we're thinking, should the election be a direct one, that might give us a bit more leverage to think about other things rather than just tearing down old institutions that may or may not continue to serve a purpose. Here's a map of the importance of the states in the 2016 election. The importance here refers to a pretty technical political science measure. The shorthand version is a state is important if you move them from one column to the other, the election changes. Right? So the winner changes based on a state moving from one side to the other. And these data are generated from pre-election surveys. So recall that there were some existential crises in the polling industry leading up to Election Day in 2016, but at least this is one indication of some states mattered and some states don't. You'll see large swaths of the country are blank. That means that they have an importance of zero, meaning they play no role in the election. Effectively, everyone in a state that has no color, or the congressional districts in Nebraska and Maine, have no effect because they could effectively vote randomly and the result of the election would not change. What is important, however, is you can see Nevada, New Mexico, New Hampshire, the upper Midwest, the Atlantic coast, and Florida appear to be important. Right? And so these are the states in which if you win these states, you're probably more likely to win the election, just given the configuration of how we're pretty sure the rest of the states are going to vote. These are the states that you should be paying attention to. The key point here is that an American presidential election really exists in two modes. You have the people who live in uncompetitive states who would be forgiven if they didn't know a race was going on. And you have the people who are in competitive states and are liable to shoot their television because they're tired of all the advertisements. Right? In essence, you end up with two different worlds, right? In the sense that some states matter, some states don't. Right? All states are equal, but some are more equal than others. Right? Here's a different way to look at the same election. These are candidate visits. So from the time of the party conventions, when we know the nominees on either side, where do the president and vice presidential candidates go between the conventions and election day? As you can see, there's a high correspondence between the important states here and the states that candidates visit. In particular, the upper Midwest, North Carolina, and Florida. Right? These turn out to be important states, right, in terms of when the actual tabulation takes place. And so here again, you see a different indication of this is where candidates are going to appeal to voters. These are the issues that candidates are paying much more attention to, and to the exclusion of the other countries, states that are effectively irrelevant. So one way to think about this is that it may matter to you very much, say, the fate of a mining proposal near the Smith River, but I hate to break it to you, no one on the national level cares. They probably don't even know that the Smith River is in Montana, right? In part because Montana is not a relevant state when candidates are thinking about where they should go, who they should be talking to, and what sort of issues they should be addressing on the campaign trail. So let me just tell you a little bit about history. Here's a map of the 1876 presidential election. This is the first instance in which the winner of the popular vote does not win the election. Poor Mr. Samuel Tilden is not inaugurated president, and instead Rutherford B. Hayes wins. But don't worry about Samuel Tilden. There's a wonderful line when he was introduced to a civic organization later in his career, and they had said he has the confidence of knowing that he has won the election to be the chief executive, but also the peace of mind of knowing he has no responsibility that comes with the job. The point here is to bear in mind that if you're looking at the color of the states, here again, blue meaning Democratic and red meaning Republican, the states look pretty close to what we've got today, except they've been inverted. Right? And so that recall that in 1876, probably the more progressive party in terms of social policy was the Republican Party. Right? The Democrats were probably the more conservative party. The parties shift position as a consequence of the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s. Right. So one argument that could be made is, well, of course, just looking at the names, Democrats always lose, Republicans always win, so therefore, if I'm a Republican, I should really like the Electoral College. I just have two things to bear in mind. One, where the parties occupy it's not fixed in time, and there's no guarantee that it will continue that way throughout time. If you want just a shorthand explanation, just ask any of your friends who is a card-carrying member of the Whig Party. Right? They existed there for a little while, then their meetings they don't happen very often anymore. It's pretty easy to get parking at the Whig Party convention. The other thing to bear in mind is that 1876 is a nice election because What you ended up with were contested ballots that were coming from the states to the U.S. Senate, and so that the Congress itself has to evaluate the various competing claims from the state delegations over which ballots they should be counting. And so if you're worried about a decline in, say, virtue in American politics, the Speaker of the House at the time is an old-school, corrupt Democrat from Philadelphia, and yet he votes contrary to his party's position and oversees a fair counting of the ballots and the inauguration of Rutherford B. Hayes. Right? And so if you're looking for an unsung hero, I would suggest the 1876 election might be a nice one to look at just in terms of how the Speaker of the House in particular behaved. The general analysis is, or at least the summation of the election, is that Vermont decided this election. So that might push against my argument that I just said that small states, it's not the small states that matter, it's the competitive states that matter. But really, that's just a function of the alphabet, because they went through and evaluated the state ballots alphabetically, and there was no question about the Virginia ballots. So Vermont decided the election only because they voted last. Similarly, in 2000, you see another case where the division between the partisan performance of the candidates is very close. Right? And as I'm sure everyone knows, in 2000, what effectively decided the election was the state of Florida, and in particular, 537 ballots, right, with a couple of recounts thrown in. The point here is that in a close election, you're more likely to see a correspondence between the popular vote and the electoral vote. But by no means does that mean that if you're ahead in the popular vote, you're going to win the electoral vote. Well, we have empirical evidence to suggest actually the inverse is true. The other two elections in which this happens is 1888. Here in 1888, you're already seeing a consolidation of the regional politics. So now you're seeing a beginning of what would then become the Solid South. The southern region of the United States is, in this case, solidly Democratic. Nowadays, we tend to think of the South as solidly Republican, though, again, that monolith is starting to fall apart as well. But the idea here is that now you're starting to see a more decisive electoral vote, even though the popular vote is remaining fairly close. So one argument here is that now Benjamin Harrison is winning the competitive states, and Grover Cleveland is losing the competitive states, but probably winning the non-competitive states. An analogy to the, say, World Series of Baseball may be apt, in the sense that if you win four of the seven games but by a close margin, and the opposing team wins the last game with a huge margin, who wins the series? Well, it depends on how you count the votes. If you're counting on the basis of winning individual games, one person wins. If you're counting on the individual basis of runs scored, another team may win. The question only here is that for the Electoral College, what actually matters is winning in a particular constellation of states, not actually winning the election. So again, this may be one point to bear out when you're thinking, should the election for the presidency be a direct election? Should the winner of the election be the winner? In that case, it almost sort of begs the answer, right? And then, of course, 2016 is a notable election, too, because we, again, have the fourth instance in which the winner of the popular vote does not win the election. The only thing I'll say here is that you're seeing the upper Midwest effectively decides this election. The margin here is 80,000 votes between Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Had they gone a different way, Hillary Clinton would have been president. The idea that you can predict 80,000 votes in a pool of 120 million is absurd. Right? Speaking as a semi-educated statistician, it's difficult to come up with identifying in advance of the election that those states were going to be the ones that mattered. This is when what boils down a lot in success in politics comes down to luck. And I think the Trump campaign may have had a perfectly executed strategy, but I find it problematic to think that they could have predicted the margin that they were going to win given the electoral map that they were looking at, particularly leading into Election Day, when it seemed all of the pundits and commentators were pretty certain that Hillary Clinton was going to sail into a fairly unproblematic electoral victory. This was a surprise, I think, to everyone. Okay. If we're thinking about ways in which we might reform the system, I think the leading candidate for reform is this thing called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. This was designed by two lawyers, so obviously they are not marketing people, because National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is a mouthful, doesn't really flow very easily. But the point here is that that it is an interstate compact, and since it's an agreement between the states to give all of their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote. In effect, the Electoral College will continue to exist, but it will be something akin to, say, the monarch in Great Britain. Royal assent is given to every bill that passes through Parliament. In essence, the Electoral College will ratify whatever decision the American people make. The compact itself will only become effective when there are at least 270 electoral votes in the compact, meaning once you've got a workable majority within the compact, then all of these states will then agree amongst themselves that, in effect, whoever wins the popular vote will win the electoral vote, because by definition all of the states are bound to do so. One opponent of this reform has called it an end run around the Constitution because it avoids the necessity of a constitutional amendment to actually implement, say, abolishing or radically reconfiguring the Electoral College. One observation here is that perhaps the founders, in another oversight of theirs, made it overly difficult to amend the Constitution. I mean, one of their geniuses was that they came up with a process by which you could amend the Constitution. And yet, at least comparatively speaking, based on evidence from other countries, the American amendment procedure is quite onerous relative to other countries. And so one argument may be one reason why we haven't amended the Constitution very much is that because it's pretty difficult to do. And so this may be an easier way to effectively do the same thing, but without the necessity of a constitutional amendment. So this is a goofy-looking map of the country where one square is the same as one electoral vote. And it gives you an idea of the progress of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. At the moment, 12 states have joined the compact. Connecticut is the most recent to have done so. And within those states, you have 172 electoral votes, or about 64% of the required 270. So the good news is that the reform effort is well underway and is more than halfway to getting the required 270. The bad news, however, is if you're looking at the states that have already joined the compact, you'll probably see that all of them are in the so-called blue state column. Right? This, I think, feeds into the conception that Democrats are angry that the Electoral College still exists, and now they're trying to get rid of it because Democrats want to win the presidency every once in a while. However, there are some houses within state legislatures that have, in at least the red state column, also adopted these reforms. So North Carolina, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, for example, have all passed these reforms, even though there were Republican majorities in these states. So it may be not the case that there's a partisan dimension to speaking as a social scientist, I don't see much evidence to suggest that, say, the Democrats would always win the popular vote and always lose the electoral vote, just because of where the parties position themselves changes over time, and it's not at all fixed that we will have the same two parties exist into the future. And so I think the more important thing is just thinking about, if we want fairness, where is this movement going to have to go? And you're going to think, well, you're going to have to make inroads into other states. And so one argument may be, what's the angle for, say, Texans to be worried about the Electoral College? Well, let's imagine a scenario in which a Democrat wins the electoral vote and loses the popular vote. We may imagine that Republicans will find a new found sense that perhaps the Electoral College is not working the way it should be. The good news, though, is that social scientists and a bunch of other nonpartisan apolitical folks will say, hey, welcome to the party. I mean, all of us have been identifying this problem for a long time. Maybe we can finally work together. And I'll comment on that in a little bit in the conclusions. But the idea is that some states have adopted this wholesale, but the question is where you're going to find the remaining electoral votes to actually make the compact effective. The other point to remember is that the states that have already adopted the compact have done so through the legislature passing a bill and the governor signing the bill. There is, of course, a separate policymaking avenue in the sense of the initiative and referendum. And so the one discussion that's going on in Oregon may be that if the Oregonians want the reform, they may have to submit to a popular initiative in order to adopt it. In Oregon, it's in the past two legislatures, they've adopted the bill in the state house, and it has always been stymied in the state senate. And I guess the reformers in Oregon are getting tired with one particular state senator, and they're like, all right, fine, we're just going to do this as an initiative. And that may be a different venue for other states that have direct democratic institutions, which tend to be in the West. The states back east don't have the ballot initiative and the referendum. Let's imagine, for the sake of argument, that the Electoral College is done away with, whether through the National Popular Vote or some other way. What are some potential impacts of this change? The first caveat here is that, as a social scientist, we really have no idea, because we've never seen a presidential election that doesn't have the Electoral College. That being said, we can make a couple of analogous arguments based on what we observe in other elections in the United States. And so one point that's probably likely is that turnout may increase in presidential elections. We've got a pretty good idea of what impacts relative turnout. One mechanism is that battleground states tend to have higher turnout than non-competitive states. And if we imagine that the national popular vote, in effect, evens out competition across the states, and so that you won't have, say, Ohio adopting most of the attention and the other states getting the short end of the stick, you might imagine that turnout will increase in these previously uncompetitive or neglected states. The parties, of course, will have incentives to mobilize voters across the country, and so that may mean a separate mechanism is when a party contacts you and says, hey, remember to vote, it actually substantially increases your likelihood of casting a ballot. Right? And so then what you've got is both the competition of a given state, where the perception that my vote actually matters increases the likelihood of turning out, and when the parties are calling you and contacting you in various ways to say, hey, remember to vote, you actually do. But one obvious reservation is, of course, will the major parties only compete in major cities? And will they just give up on so-called flyover country? For the sake of argument, let's imagine one party devotes all of their attention to voters in New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Houston, Dallas, whatever, the major cities, and they give up on the rest of the country. Here is an incentive for the opposition to spend all of their time mobilizing the voters that the first campaign is forgetting. And so in a sense that if the parties are acting strategically, they're going to be reacting to whatever one party is doing and the other one isn't. And so then you might imagine, well, if one party is only campaigning in the major cities, it's potential, there is the potential at least, that you could overcome that block of voters by appealing to other voters. And that might imply that the parties as we know them may change. And so then what you may end up with is a different coalition of interest groups within both of the parties that are now being responsive to a different set of issues, rather than just the same old tried and true things that seem to motivate political discussions every 4 years related on topics that never seem to go away and never seem to get resolved one way or the other. Probably what will happen is that the pace of the campaign will increase. So candidates will now be faced with a much larger map that they have to go to. And so you'll probably see much larger efforts to get presidential candidates everywhere in the country. You'll probably see larger groups of surrogates who are acting on behalf of candidates, just as a means of getting out and talking to voters. You're probably going to see an increase in advertising, because suddenly new blocks of the American electorate will now be important for counting up to a majority of the vote. But of course, along with all of this, the cost of an election is naturally going to increase, because we're already spending, on average, a few billion dollars every 4 years on a presidential election. And so what you're going to end up with is, if the parties have to identify even more voters that they need to contact, that's going to require a larger investment on the parts of parties, candidates, fundraisers, and so forth. There, of course, this may be a separate question that's worth thinking about, but it seems obvious that the cost of an election will increase if suddenly campaigns have to have a presence everywhere in the country rather than just token offices some places and much more devoted staffs elsewhere in the country. One case that I think is worth looking into for comparative information is Finland. Finland is, of course, a wonderful country that I think everyone should visit if you get the chance. Finland is remarkable because in the early 1990s, they abolished their electoral college. And so as a means to get to talking about that, let me tell you a little bit about Finnish politics. In short, Finland does their politics completely different than we do. We elect 435 members of the House on the basis of single-member districts in a majoritarian election. Right? So whoever gets the most votes wins. Finland doesn't do that. Their parliament has 200 members, and they elect everyone on the basis of what their electoral system is called open list proportional representation. So what you end up with, you go to the polling place on election day, There is a list of the parties. They, below the party names, will have a list of the candidates. You take the number of the candidate you want to vote for, you write it on a circle, you hand your ballot back. It takes, on average, about 30 seconds to fill out your ballot, because most people know who they're voting for on the way in. What happens to that ballot? They tabulate all of those votes by party, figure out how many seats each party gets, and then the party can fill those seats based on who gets which the highest number of votes within each party. So what you tend to see are celebrities in Finland will run for office with the idea that they may win a seat in parliament, but if they don't, they may collect more votes for the party itself to then get additional seats that they can hand out to whomever they are, is on their party list. Right. So what you end up with are 200 parliamentarians. In essence, you really have 199 because the Åland Islands elect one member of parliament, but for the most, they have a completely different party system. They have a completely different electoral system. In a country where 95% of the population speaks Finnish, the Ålanders speak Swedish. The Åland Islands are generally omitted when in a discussion of Finnish politics, just to make things simple. But if you suffer from insomnia, feel free to ask me questions about the Åland Islands during the Q&A. I can tell you fun stories about when the League of Nations actually did something as opposed to was sort of ineffectual. In the most recent parliamentary elections in 2015, you had eight parties win seats in parliament, excluding the Åland coalition. So in essence, you have multiple parties that have representation, and they run the gamut from far left, unreconstructed communists to far right, nationalist, populist, and so forth. Within that set of eight parties, three of them got together and formed a government. So we think of, say, at the moment, the Republicans are in the majority in the House of Representatives. We could think of the Republicans as being a single-member coalition, right, that's running the lower house. In Finland, you have three parties that come together to produce at least a majority in the parliament. As it happens, these three parties account for 62% of the parliament. Finland has a tradition of oversized governing majorities, probably because the Finns seem to think that everyone should have a seat at the table, right? Including occasionally Americans. Right? So you know, I represented the American caucus for a period of time. As I was walking down the street, and the guy goes, "Well, you got to keep Tampere Finnish." And I said, "Well, I'm the only American in town. I don't think you have a problem." If there is opposition, it's very rare that that opposition is displayed publicly. Instead, that's hammered out in closed-door meetings among the cabinet. And so the prime minister will say, the government was going to do X. The other parties in the coalition can say, well, we're generally in favor of this, but we want some changes made, or we'll only vote for this if you do something else. All of that's hammered out behind closed doors. But then when you get to the press conference and they start voting in parliament, generally speaking, the governing parties will vote as a bloc, to assure themselves that they remain in the government. It's very rare that you will see members of the governing parties split and publicly vote no on some policy that the government is supporting. And turnout in the last parliamentary elections was 70%, which is substantially higher than typical turnout in congressional elections in the U.S. The academics tend to debate how we can think of Finnish politics in the sense of if we think of them as a semi-presidential system, meaning the president is elected separately from parliament and still has some role to play, similar to, say, how the French do it with sometimes the president is important in France, given if the president's party also controls a majority in the National Assembly. The powers of the president are somewhat reduced in France if the opposition controls the National Assembly. In those cases, the president tends to run foreign policy, the prime minister tends to deal with domestic policy, and they don't really talk to each other. Right. Or if Finland is more of just a parliamentary system where the prime minister runs most of the show. There have been a series of constitutional amendments. The most recent was in 1999 that dramatically changed the balance of power between president and parliament so that nowadays I think it's safe to say that Finland is a parliamentary system, though there are some mostly ceremonial roles that are reserved for the president in terms of chief representative of the Finnish nation, some role in foreign policy. Probably the best example of this is recently Sauli Niinistö, the president of Finland, played host to another summit with two other presidents who you may have heard of, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, in Helsinki, a lovely city to visit if you ever get the chance. The presidential palace is quite lovely from the outside, and I'm told it's even nicer on the inside. They didn't let me go inside. What have presidential elections looked like in Finland? There have been basically two phases of elections in Finland. The first, between 1919 and 1988, was a series of indirect elections. And these happened in a number of ways. In a couple of instances, you have the parliament actually electing the president themselves. This happened in 1919, the first presidential election in Finland. Finland is a relatively young country, only coming on the map in 1917 when they split from then Russia and then shortly to become the Soviet Union, in part because the Finns didn't really like Bolshevism. And so as the Russian Civil War is going on, there's a similar civil war going on in Finland. The Reds win in Russia and turn it into the Soviet Union. The Whites win in Finland and they remain sovereign and not return to part of the Soviet Union, contrary to the wishes of Vladimir Lenin, who had sort of said, our Finnish brothers will leave and then they will gleefully come back to the Soviet Union. It didn't work out that way. The Finnish Electoral College elected the president in most of the other elections between 1925 and 1982. The two asterisks next to 1940 and 1943 just indicate that in those elections, there was a fundamental violation of the whole Electoral College idea. Recall from the beginning where I'd said that the Electoral College comes together, they make one decision, and then they disperse, never to meet as that body again. The Finns, probably as an example of wartime efficiency, just said, well, in the presidential elections in 1940 and 1943, let's just call back the Electoral College from 1937. They did a decent job then. Let's just have them do it again, because it's easier to just have those same folks make the decision rather than have a new set of folks have to meet in Helsinki in the midst of a war. And so in those instances, you have the same electors voting on who the president should be. 1988 is something of a watershed election in Finland because here you have, for the first time, the Electoral College and a direct election to decide who the president would be. The idea being, let's see if we get the same person on the two different tabulation methods. The good news is that it did work out that way, that the same guy wins the election. And so then this ushers in an era of reform where the incoming president says, well, why don't we try and just revisit this Electoral College entirely and say, this will ultimately lead to an abolition of the Electoral College. That's finished in 1991, and there have been two-round direct elections since 1994. What the two-round system means is that you have everyone run in the first round. If someone gets a majority of the vote, then they're declared the winner. If they are less than 50%, the top two then go on to the second round. And this has been the case in the four elections since 1994. 2018 is a remarkable event in Finnish political history because here you have the incumbent president win in the first round. And I say this is a remarkable event because when I went into the department meeting and I said, a historic event has just happened in Finland, and all of my colleagues said, what happened in Norway? What? So apparently the people who worry about Finnish politics are quite small on this side of the Atlantic. I had no idea. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why the Finnish Electoral College was eliminated. And in large part, that's going to involve a discussion of this fellow here in the picture. That's Urho Kekkonen, who was the longtime Finnish president. He was president from 1956 to 1982. And the concern is that over time, he became something of a polarizing figure in Finnish political history. His critics would complain that toward the end of his term as president, he became a bit more authoritarian than he was at the beginning. And his supporters would say, well, he had to defend the Finnish nation. And so he had to do things that would say, perhaps not pass muster nowadays, but hey, Finland's still an independent country, so it must have worked. one other element that involves here is this is our fellow that's identified, Mauno Koivisto, was at the end of Kekkonen's presidency, the prime minister. And as far as we can tell, the two of them didn't like each other very much. When Kekkonen retires from the presidency for reasons of ill health, Koivisto becomes president and initially begins a phase of, let's reconsider if we really are comfortable with the president of Finland being the president for 26 years. At a stretch, and so Koivisto becomes, one, the first social democratic president in Finnish history. Kekkonen comes from a much more conservative right-of-center party, the center party. And so one idea is that do we really want the next president to be in charge for a quarter of a century? there seemed to be a consensus that the Finns were not pleased with this system, and so this ushers in a degree of discussions about how we can change the system. Here now, the hybrid election in 1988 is important because here's an experiment. Well, let's see. Can we run a direct election and come up with the same answer as the Electoral College? If yes, do we really need the Electoral College any longer? We can just have the Finnish people decide who they want their president to be. And so Koivisto sort of oversees a parliamentary debate in 1990 and 1991 related to the actual abolition of the Electoral College. And here I'm working on a project with a Finnish master's student. My understanding of Finnish is quite limited. His understanding of Finnish is excellent. And so we're going through the actual transcripts of the debates to try and figure out what the parliamentarians were thinking when they were implementing this reform. In the middle of this discussion, however, there's a parliamentary election. And the center party, Kekkonen's party, wins, and they become the prime minister. And so one question is, if the center party is operating rationally or for only partisan gain, you could imagine the prime minister would say, let's just end this reform of the Electoral College. After all, we won under the old system. Let's keep the old system around. The remarkable thing, however, is that that doesn't happen. And instead, the center party splits over this question of the Electoral College, but the overwhelming majority of the rest of the parties vote in favor of the reform. And so you end up with a reform being conducted under circumstances which we might not predict it taking place. After all, who's going to handicap their own party in the next presidential election? So, as I said before, the Electoral College is abolished formally in 1991, and since 1994, the Finnish presidential elections have taken on a different tone than they had prior. Going through these parliamentary records is enlightening for a couple of reasons, because you can show what the parliamentarians are thinking about. And forefront in their minds is, it, is the party system going to change under this new electoral system? In particular, will Finland be a two-party system as a consequence of eliminating the Electoral College? Here, the data seems to be mixed. While it is true that after the reform, only two parties have held the presidency, but if you look back before the reform took place, what you see is ultimately there are roughly two blocs that are competing for the presidency as well. Sometimes this bloc are one party versus another party, a group of parties versus another group of parties, the opposition versus Kekkonen, these sorts of things are, but it basically boils down to one group facing off against another group. One argument here is that actually has very little to do with the Electoral College or the direct election, but rather just a function of you're competing over one seat that cannot be divided. And so in a case where you're looking at a single member district, at least a lot of social science research would show us that you're going to end up with two blocks that roughly straddle the middle of the electorate as a means to try and get a working majority to win the election. So the concern is that will abolishing the Electoral College make Finland a two-party system? The simple answer appears to be no. Finland is still a vibrant multi-party democracy. Not a whole lot has changed in that regard. Another question that's related to that, though, is that will the small parties cease to be relevant? And this is a concern because when you have eight parties, some of them are going to be large, by which I mean they may win a quarter to a third of the vote, and some parties will be small, meaning that they will win 5 or 6% of the vote. And so one question is, do these small parties lose what little relevance they have? The evidence here seems to be no. a nice example of this is party in Finland, the Swedish People's Party. So about 5% of the Finnish population speaks Swedish as their native language. They've organized themselves into a political party. And the neat thing about the Swedish People's Party is they tend to be in government with anyone. They'll do business with any of the other parties in Finland because all they care about is respect for linguistic minorities in Finland. And so as a member of a linguistic minority when I was in Finland, I was very appreciative of the Swedish People's Party's efforts to, say, have street names in more languages than Finnish because that helped me get to work in the morning. Right. Or to know what station I was supposed to get off when I was on the train, because otherwise I'd screw things up and I'd end up, you know, in Lapland or something. And so the Swedish People's Party is a nice example of a small party that, as long as you're willing to accommodate linguistic minorities, they're happy to do business with you. Conversely, if you're running for president and you say, well, we are a Finnish nation, let's just get rid of all of this accommodation for Swedish speakers, you've now just lost 5% of support, which may be irrelevant if your coalition is sufficiently large, but may be relevant if you need those 5% to win. Right? And so here you've got an incentive for small parties to assert themselves in a meaningful way. There was some concern that if you have a two-round election, is turnout going to decline in the second round? People will get tired or they'll get bored. Evidence seems to suggest instead that turnout increases by about a point or so in the second round. Probably because if you're only looking at two choices, so the joke in France that has a similar two-round system is in the first round you vote for who you like, in the second round you vote against the person you don't like. Right? And so that explains sort of why the National Front will probably never be the president in France, because not a whole lot of people like the party, and then they sort of take glee in voting against the party. Right? I think the same mechanism, but to a slighter degree, is also present in Finland, in the sense that they vote in a positive vote in the one case, and then in the second round a negative vote for whoever they don't like. There was also a question about why don't we just have a preferential electoral system? The Finns didn't seem to spend a whole lot of time deliberating on this system. This is where, say, seven candidates run and you just rank them in order of preference. There was an expert-level committee that was put together of all of the electoral studies scholars in Finland, and they contributed to this reform. Those folks tend to talk about the Irish presidential system, which operates on a preferential basis, but it didn't seem to have much leverage with parliamentarians. Only a couple of people would mention it in passing, and in my informal discussions with members of this expert commission, they had sort of said, we really didn't know what we were talking about. And we just sort of said, yes, Ireland does it this way, and then we moved on to other things that we were a bit more comfortable talking about. So that's a viable alternative, but it wasn't considered in the Finnish case. And then lastly, they were concerned about the polarization in Parliament, in the sense that are the parties going to be at each other's throats as a consequence of abolishing the Electoral College? Here, too, the good news is no, in part because the logic of coalition building means that you can't really insult the other party because you may have to depend on those votes when it comes time to making a coalition. The other thing is that when you have multiple parties that occupy different places in the political dimension, you're going to end up with parties that represent a pretty decent slice of the Finnish electorate. So let's say you are a populist that is now starting to be concerned that, well, some of the Finnish identity is being diluted. After all, the street signs are in Swedish now. There is a party that accommodates your views. Right? Let's say you are a unreformed Marxist who still thinks that the Soviet invasion of Hungary was a good idea. There is a party that accommodates your views. Right? And the neat thing, when I'm sitting on the train and a guy starts talking to me, he's a communist in Finland, and he's telling me about, well, one day the workers will rise. And I said, really, when's that going to happen? Well, any day now. You just wait. Right? And then I asked him, well, what magazines do you read? Oh, I'm a lifetime subscriber to Reader's Digest. Okay, well, I'll be keeping an eye out for a call to arms in Reader's Digest. So the good news is that the polarization in Finland has not dramatically changed. There has been an uptick recently with the introduction of a openly populist party. That party has instead split into two, and it's an open question as to whether or not either of those two factions within the party will exist in the next parliamentary election. So Finland is still a very easygoing place to be, especially if you're a member of a language minority. But one other question that attracted a lot of attention from the parliamentarians, were should the abolition of the Electoral College be wheeled in with other reforms? And so here's where we get into the adjustment of the balance of power between president and parliament, and other questions about, let's say, reduce the length of a presidential term, or say a president can only run for two consecutive terms, or something like this. One issue that became apparent was that when Kekkonen was president, he would occasionally insist on deciding which parties would be in government. And you might imagine that this would be ridiculous, given that that tends to be the purview of parliament. Kekkonen's argument, however, was, we have a neighbor to the east that might invade us any day now, and so it might be helpful if occasionally we put the Finnish Communist Party in government, just so when I talk to Khrushchev or whatever, he can say, look, we have a Communist Party in government, right? Don't invade us. It'd be really nice if he didn't, right? And so one argument was that this occupied a sort of strategic role for the president, but with the fall of the Soviet Union and the departure of Kekkonen himself, parliament was less enamored with this quality, and so one of the things that they said was that now the president will only have a limited role in coalition talks, and instead that will be largely the role of parliament. The other point that one member of parliament raised was that when Kekkonen was initially elected president in 1956, he did so on the virtue of one electoral vote. And so they thought, perhaps we don't want a system in which one person gets elected president on the virtue of one vote and then remains in office for years and years. And so this was sort of also roped into the larger discussion of limiting the powers of the Finnish president. Let me just wrap up with a couple of conclusions. I think the first point, at least I think a convincing case can be made that the founders in America were skeptical of small-d democracy. They instead preferred a republican form of government where the American electorate generally elects a group of elites that will then make all of the decisions. And I think the Electoral College nicely fits into that logic. The question is, does that logic still apply? In the sense that it may be the case that the Electoral College has become a sort of antiquated relic of a bygone era. And instead, if we buy the argument that the American people are now able to make this decision intelligently, they should be able to do so. There have been a number of biases that have crept into presidential politics that perhaps were unanticipated by the founders. Most obviously, this idea that occasionally a losing candidate can win the election. At least for the Finns, this was an absurd conclusion. And so they said, let's just eliminate this possibility entirely and make sure that whoever wins the election is the winner. The abolition of the Electoral College will definitely change how presidential politics are conducted. Though, again, we're not entirely sure what this different mode of electioneering would look like, but we do have some suspicion based on, say, well, what happens in Senate elections or gubernatorial elections. So the idea is that eliminating the incentives for the parties will change how they behave, and as rational actors, the campaigns will do a pretty good job of adapting to whatever the new environment is, and that may involve talking to considerably more voters than just, say, Rust Belt folks or NASCAR dads or soccer moms or whatever the sub-constituency of the week tends to be, at least from the political consulting world. If we take a broader view and look at the global situation, electoral colleges are becoming rarer. In fact, the American Electoral College is one of the only that remains in the world. The other one being the College of Cardinals that elects the Pope. Though, of course, the question here is that the cardinals are not actually directly elected, so perhaps it's not an apt category to be included with. Generally speaking, the Latin America and South America had a number of electoral colleges. They're all been abolished, more or less. France had an electoral college, but abolished it as a referendum in 1962. One argument for why I think Finland might be a better case to pay attention to is that their legislature abolished the Electoral College, and there is no national-level referendum that's possible in the United States. And so the French model of abolishing the Electoral College may be less relevant. Another reason why Finland is probably a better country to become acquainted with. And then lastly, I think if you want a reform to happen, the important thing here is you have consensus from the major parties. I think that was the case in Finland, where there was virtual unanimous agreement that the status quo as it was no longer sustainable. Similarly, in the ratification process for both the 12th Amendment, as a consequence of dealing with having a president and a vice president who hate each other, and perhaps thinking maybe we should make it so that these guys run as a pair rather than just give the runner-up the second job. Another analogy is the 22nd Amendment, when after FDR's extended presidency, we change the rules and say a president can only be a president for at most 8 years. Important point to remember here is that the Republican Party is really taking the long view in this sense, because if you might recall, their president at the time, Dwight Eisenhower, could easily have run for a third term and probably would have been reelected, and the Democrats probably would have run Adlai Stevenson against him a third time, and you could have a 3-0 win for Eisenhower. You could effectively just have 7 elections, have them reenact the World Series in miniature, right? But the important point here is that there was a consensus among the parties that, say, having a president stay in office as long as they wanted, or the concern was that a president would stay in office for the remainder of their life, is perhaps not a good idea. And so the parties came together and changed the rules, both as a consequence of a recognition that the system wasn't working that inspired the 12th Amendment and to inspire the 22nd Amendment. So with that, I'll conclude my prepared remarks and take any of your questions. Thank you.